طاح ديما طاح بوم مشتاق.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the Middle East Center for a Tuesday night seminar exploring Israel's covert relations in the Middle East, 1948 to 2020. And to address this topic, we are so delighted to be welcoming back Professor Eli Cordet of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Eli is the Bamberger and Full Professor in the History of the Muslim Peoples in the Department of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at the Hebrew University, where he's served in various honorary capacities, chairing his department as president of the Middle East and Islamic Studies Association of Israel, and a board member of MITZVIM, the Israeli Institute for Regional Foreign Policies. These honors fall on the shoulders of Professor Cordet as a reflection of his demonstrated authority in so wide a range of subjects. He has authored more than 14 books, more than 80 academic articles, in Hebrew, in Arabic, and in English. His most recent book, we see on the screen, the Hebrew language readers in the audience will know better than I, is Israel's Secret Relations with States and Minorities in the Middle East between 1948 and 2020, published in 2022. An English edition is forthcoming.
And yes.
It's taken a while to make this happen.
Right.
I'm glad we finally got there. Right. May I invite you to the podium to give us your lecture? Join me in welcoming Professor Eli Cordet.
Thank you very much, Eugene. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, let me start and say, the famous comedian Groucho Marx, he said, before I speak, I have something important to say. So, before I start my lecture, first of all, I want to thank Eugene. It's kind of a closure of a circle because I was spending my sabbatical at the Middle East Center at LSE 3 years ago, 2020, and then I was supposed to give a lecture on the same topic. The book was not yet out, and then two things happened. One, of course, is the corona, and eventually I had to fly back home to cut short my sabbatical. And we went back, so obviously the lecture did not happen. And then what the second thing that happened was the signing of the Abraham Accords. And that was in the second half of 2020. And when it happened, my first reaction was, wow, I wish my book was already out, because in some way it was connected, as you'll see in a minute. But then after reflection, I did understand that I was very lucky that it was not out, because I managed to relate to that and also to see that in many ways it was the consummation of a long process that I was talking in my book. And eventually it even led me to change the title of the book. And you'll see in a minute why, but that's only some remarks, you know, in order to understand, in general, the big picture. Now, finally, I want to say something about the picture before we start. Now, this is a very famous picture in Israel, which shows King Hussein and Prime Minister Rabin immediately after the signing of the peace agreement in Arava. This is in Hussein's palace or house in Aqaba. And this is a very intimate moment, and obviously it's a public moment. However, you don't know, I mean, what is behind this story, and the story is that this is an imitation of another incident that occurred between King Hussein and the correspondent of Yediot Ahronot, Smadar Peri. She was interviewing, and at the end or in the middle of the interview, you know, they either stop the interviews, and both of them have smokers, and they had a smoke, and then King Hussein lit the cigarette of Smadar, a very noble gesture. And that appeared on Yediot Ahronot, it became public. And Rabin saw that, and when they met, he said, I want that picture, or something similar. So, and that I heard from Smadar Peri at her house, And by the way, she has another picture of herself and Jim Hossein. So this is a small little story, you know, that is behind the story. A little bit, I would say, secret, but you know, not everyone knows. Okay, so now we can go to business and to talk about what I have done. First of all, in terms of historiography, what I was trying to do, I think that I myself, and I know there are quite a few people here in the audience, they dedicated themselves to a lot of work in the Israeli, British, American archive, and myself included. And therefore, I mean, we obviously, we pay a lot of attention to the documents that we find. Now look at this quotation that says the following. Historians have a general tendency to pay too much attention to the evidence which survives and to make too little allowance for what does not. Intelligence has become a missing dimension first and foremost because its written records are so difficult to come by. And that is actually so because so many things happen behind the scenes and we have no idea. Think about the Mossad, think about the Shabak, think about other intelligence branches that are working all the time and are doing important things. Some of them are very significant and we know very little or not at all about what happened. And that made me look at a different direction and try to look at other things that I myself have done quite a lot of work in the normal, regular archives, but really we are looking at something different. So if secret, what are the sources? So obviously the archival material is very important and here you have all the new material and so on. So this is something which is basic and always is in use. But beyond that, they leak the confidential documents like the WikiLeaks. I think that scholars sometimes they don't have enough appreciations to what they can find in this material. Now, obviously, it's a kind of coincidence because it depends on the term that you use and the information that is in there. It's not very much organized and so on. But if you are lucky, you can find a lot. And I found quite a lot, especially about Israel's secret relation in the Gulf. So that was very revealing and added a lot. The media sources, the information leaked to the media at the time, and that always, I find it as an underrated source of information for the historians. Also Arabic sources, you know, the Arabic newspapers, for example. I mean, in the past I used to work on that, and I really appreciate that, but also here. And I mainly talk about whether it's the Israeli or the Western newspapers, because at the time, in the 50s and the 60s, along the year, there were many leaks. And in time, they were forgotten. But when you look backward and you have a better perspective and more information, then you know, I mean, what was more truthful or what is more relevant and so on. So that is an additional a source of information. The memoirs of people involved in the events, obviously, is always important. And then the personal interviews of people involved in the clandestine activity. Now, that was a very meaningful source for me. I interviewed more than 100 people from the Mossad, intelligence, and foreign office, and so on. And that I found very interesting because one thing that happens in Israeli society is that people want to talk. People want to tell their story. I mean, that was not normal a thing to do in the 50s and the 60s, but you know, today or in recent years, with the amount of information that we do have sometimes in real time, then this is a different ball game. And I even can tell you, this is really even funny. I mean, when the book came out, then afterward, I mean, some people got in touch with me. They wanted to talk. So I have additional information and might be included, you know, You said, yes, it was published only in Hebrew for the time being. I have a contract with Indiana University Press, so I'm just looking for the money for the translation, but it will come, and it will eventually it will be published. So hopefully, you know, this new information will be included in the new version. Okay, so let's move. The major thesis, or let's say some of the conclusions that I would not want to repeat at the end, are the following. First of all, Israel was not as isolated as described in the accepted Israeli historiography and as claimed by the decision maker, okay? Although this is something that, I mean, in Israeli Zionist and Israeli historiography, it's a common argument. And when you see the spread, the amount, you know, of the occurrences and the cooperation, I mean, no doubt the bottom line is that Israel, I would not say Israel was not isolated, period, but not as isolated as described in the past. Second, in its quest for allies in the Middle East, Israel's policy suffered from what I termed the mistress syndrome, which was a result of the Arab or the Middle East state unwillingness to publicly expose the relations due to the reasons that I will explain later. Now, this is something that I invented, but as I'll show you in a minute, it was not a complete invention because it was based on something. And therefore, what I was trying to look for the features of what I call the mistress syndrome. It meant that it had certain characteristics, certain features, which were very relevant to Israel's foreign policy in the Middle East. Next, as time went by, in the post-1979 Israel-Egyptian peace treaty, the Oslo Accord, and particularly the Abraham Accord, more and more countries are willing to expose their relations with Israel, which turns into a recognized partner. Okay, so this is the process, and that's why the Abraham Accord was so important. When you go, some of you maybe know Hebrew, when you go to the Hebrew title, that's exactly what it says. Yidua b'tzibur is a very Israeli term. It's very hard to translate it, so I would say a recognized partner. That's the closest that I can translate it. And there is a process. Israel moves from one state to another. This is, as you'll see, it has not been completed. But next, this process takes place primarily between the government, as the public in general boycotts Israel. This is something that we have to remember. Still, the Abraham Accord brought to light a new warm version of normalization, in contrast to the known cold model with Egypt and Jordan. I will say something about it later. And finally, Israel's growing acceptance in the Middle East is not irreversible. It depends also on Israel's policy, particularly with regard to the Palestinian issue, including Jerusalem. And we had at least one good example from the past, the fact that at the beginning of the second Palestinian Intifada, Al-Aqsa Intifada, Morocco, Tunisia, Oman, Qatar, and Mauritania, all of them cut off their relations with Israel, okay? So that is a possibility. Okay, now very quickly, I don't have enough time to go into it, but a little bit about the features of Israel's place in the region in the post-1948 period. A garrison state, a foreign policy, which means the foreign policy is subject to national security consideration. To some extent, this is the situation till today. I mean, not so much the garrison state as much as the national security dictates its foreign policy. It's a small country, again, not anymore, but in terms of territory, that was the situation until 67, and population, again, not relevant today or in recent decades, largely isolated and ostracized in the region, but there is a gap between the reality and the image. The image is very much, and this to some extent even today, the image is of a lonely state, isolated, ostracized. Daniel Bartal called it siege mentality, which many of the Israelis, I mean, are guided by this mentality. And this has nothing to do with reality, because it goes hand in hand with the reality. So the situation sometimes is A, but people, they have a certain perception that the situation is big. Search for superpowers support, obviously, this is a very important pillar of Israel's foreign policy. At the beginning, it was France in the 50s until the Six Days War, and then the United States replaced it, but that is a major feature of Israel's foreign policy. And then the desire to belong syndrome, that's a feature that I called, meant that Israel wanted to join anyone. Someone would accept me, whether it's NATO, the Middle East Command in the 50s, the Middle East Defense Organization in the 50s, the Balkan Pact, there was such a thing as well, the Baghdad Pact in the 50s, the Common Market, EU, or any unilateral guarantees. I mean, anyone, please accept us. The same issue was with the UN. I mean, for many years, we were members of the UN, but we are not part of a bloc. And if you are not part of a bloc, then you cannot sit in any committee of the UN. That changed already in the year around the 2000. And the search for possible allies in the Middle East region. And here, this is actually where my book comes into effect. I mean, this is what I have concentrated on. I mean, the relations with the Middle East, the search for allies. And here you see some of the examples of countries that Israel was looking for contact with the president. Okay? Now, let's say something about Israel's key roles in the region, because my main argument was that Israel was not isolated and that Israel was playing a role. So what kind of a role? Now, actually, if you look at Israel's role in the Middle East, even in the Arab world, I would say, and there is a slight difference, of course, between the two. Israel's role in the Middle East, I found at least six. And along the book, I refer to all of them in one way or another along the years. So these are only the titles. Unifying their states. I mean, when they have a common enemy, which is Israel, it is unifying their state. Conversely, you can talk about the divisive, especially when Arab states, certain Arab states, decided to sign an agreement, Egypt 79, Jordan 94, and so on. So that caused schism, a division among the Arab states. Intrusive, Israel involved in the internal affairs of other Midland states. There is, in the literature, there is a debate to what extent Israel was involved. So I can say something about that maybe later. We can broaden the horizon, but in general, I would say Israel was involved, but not to that extent that some people think. I can give examples later. Encouraging or accelerating different processes in their world. For example, no doubt that Israel did not invent Palestinian nationalism. Right, but no doubt that it did accelerate the process of strengthening Palestinian nationalism, the collision or the clash between the two national movements. So that is a factor. Balancer, anyone who deals from international relations talk about balancing, Israel's balancing role in the Middle East. Once you have a hegemonic power, like Nasser's Egypt in the 50s and the 60s, like Saddam Hussein in the 90s, like Iran later on, you know. So Israel was always looking for a partner, someone to cooperate with against this enemy, or to intervene once this power is intimidating or threatening a specific country. For example, Jordan in the Black September 1917, Israel played a very important role in defending Jordan. And finally, mediator, which I must admit, I was a little bit surprised to see. I mean, we all know about this, but I mean, to that extent, I didn't know how Israel played a role in mediating between the Arab states and the United States. Well, mediating, maybe is not the right word, delivering or helping the Arab state on many occasions, with Jordan, with Egypt, and Morocco, the Kurds, and many more. So this is it. Okay. One thing that I didn't, for some reasons, I see that it's missing in this version. I wanted to show you, all the to show you the comprehensiveness of the research, because it dealt with, so let me just say, 13 countries and 3 minorities from 48 until 2020. So this is very wide and comprehensive, that deal with many countries. And I think that one of the advantages is that you can get a glimpse of the general picture, not only to look at the specific antidotes and there were many. All right, let's look at the map of Israel in the 60s. And please remember that, because we'll go there and see the current map. But the dominant color is, of course, red. Red are the so-called enemies. So whether it's Egypt or those tied with Egypt, Arab nation, Arabism, and so on. The blue color is the countries that have formal diplomatic relations with Israel. At that time, only Turkey signed in 1949. The green is those countries that we have, or elements that we have, Israel has clandestine relations. Quite a lot, many of them on the periphery. Iran, please remember, it's a different Iran under the rule of the Shah until 79. I mean, that was quite an amazing story. I mean, the kind of relations that Israel had with Iran at that time. I mean, most of the oil to Israel came from Iran. Israel sold a lot of arms and ammunition to Iran. And more, I mean, a very strong connection, a very a secret one, but a very strong one. And then you have the Kurds in northern Iraq. That was a very important and interesting episode. Jordan, of course, along the years, and sits with us, Avi Schlein, who wrote so much, and I used also, Avi, your excellent book on King Hussein, the biography, and you are talking there about something like more than 50 meetings between King Hussein and the different Israeli prime ministers and politicians. So that is an important country along the years that cooperated behind the scenes with Israel. And then you have in Africa, Ethiopia, and Morocco at the other end. Now, what Israel had in the 50s and the 60s is what is called the Periphery Alliance, which was cooperation behind the scenes with Turkey and Iran. And that is quite known, I would imagine. But what is less known, that there was also a third southern tier, not only a northern tier, but also a southern tier that Israel was trying to establish with Ethiopia and with Sudan, and that was more or less at the same time in the late 50s, and it almost succeeded, but with Ethiopia it was a success, but with Sudan it failed, because in 1958 there was a coup in Sudan, talking about coups in Sudan, right? There was a coup in Sudan. We changed completely the regime, and it somewhat also changed the connection with Israel. Although this is a very interesting story, I just published an article on Israeli-Sudanese relations, and then you can find, you know, interesting things that happened between Israel and Jordan and Sudan. I mean, in the past I knew very little about Sudan, I must admit, and I mean the amount of relations that were between the two countries, it's quite amazing. Anyway, so there was no sudden deal. However, you don't see it in the map, but what is called the South Sudan, today it's an independent country, there was an organization called Anyanya, and he fought for the independent Christians, and they were fighting for their independence, and the Israelis, they helped them along the years, and eventually they helped them also to establish South Sudan. Okay. Israel, the features, I termed it before as the mistress syndrome. So let me explain what are the features of that syndrome. First of all, this is quite obvious. Secret and behind the scenes cooperation. Aaron Kleiman called it quiet diplomacy. Main disadvantage cannot be revealed and therefore does not strengthen Israel's international legitimacy. So the thing is that most of the people in Israel and outside, they're oblivious, they had no idea that those things are happening. So in such a way, you can understand why many of them continue to think that we are isolated. Second, the existence of mutual interest which make the enemy of my enemy my friend. This is the same logic that applies almost anywhere, but here was very relevant. Next, relationships usually do not last long as they rely on transient interest, yet occasionally they may last for long. Jordan and Morocco are two exceptions, and maybe later I'll talk about a little bit about Morocco, because I mean, it's amazing what happened between these two countries since the 50s and the 60s. The Mossad opened a branch in Morocco already in 1963, and since then, there were secret relations along the year, all the time, and they were very comprehensive. Next, the presence, the preference of states, for example, the periphery alliance, over minorities. And in Israeli foreign policy, or Zionist foreign policy, there was the notion of the minority alliance. What does it mean? It means that the Jews are a minority in the Middle East, and therefore, they have to cooperate with minorities in the Middle East, like the Kurds in Iraq, like the Christians in Lebanon, even maybe the Copts in Egypt, the Druze in Lebanon, Syria, and so on. So that some of the Israeli politicians, they stuck with that policy. I mean, to some extent, even Menachem Begin, you know, when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, it was a kind of continuation of the alliance of the minorities. However, usually, starting with Ben-Gurion, he was in favor of cooperating with states because they are more organized. They have control over the territory, they have sovereignty, they have agencies, they have intelligence, they have army. Therefore, it's preferable to cooperate with states. Next, that is proved to be very important. Institutional responsibility of the Mossad. Since the 50s, the Mossad Tevel is responsible for relations with countries that Israel do not have diplomatic relations. The Foreign Office is responsible for countries we do have diplomatic relations. However, the Mossad is responsible for the other part. Now, occasionally, the Foreign Office was involved. The Ministry of Defense, Shabak, Prime Minister's personal envoys, third-party intermediaries, journalists, and more. All of them, you know, many were involved in these kind of activities. Journalists, for example, you have no idea how many journalists. Usually, they offer themselves because they move from, you know, quite easily from one place to another. So they offer their offices, usually without success, but still, there were many interesting episodes in that respect. But what the result was, at least in Israel, is a rivalry between the institutions. And that was, I called it in Hebrew, for anyone who knows Hebrew, it's very difficult to translate as well. I called it Yerivut Mossadit, which is institutional rivalry. But at the same time, the word Mossad is included. So it means that the Mossad, of course, is the main body that supporting or is doing the job, but he had all the time rivalries with the Foreign Office and with personal envoys of the Prime Minister and so on, of who will be responsible. Even take the Abraham Accords, you know. I mean, some of them, for example, I mean, the national security apparatus, I mean, he was responsible for the connection with Morocco. In the Gulf, it was partially the Mossad, but it was also partially the Foreign Office. So the situation is, in reality, much more complicated, and you need to go into the detail, and sometimes the things, they stuck because of personal rivalry. Personal or institutional rivalries are very important in that connection. Okay, the advantages, as long as kept secret, cannot hurt their party legitimacy, strengthen trust between the parties, while leaks tend to create mistrust and suspicion. And whenever there were leaks, and there were a lot of leaks, usually by the Israelis who wanted, you know, to boast their connection. In Israel, it's very well known that Shimon Peres, for example, was a leaker, you know. He was someone that leaked information timely. However, people will be surprised to know that another major leaker was Menachem Begin. even used to stand at the Knesset, you know, in front of the member of the Knesset and read from, you know, secret protocols. And even the annexation of the Golan Heights in 1981 was a result of a leak of information that was included in one of the intelligence reports, which he leaked out. Okay. Now, here, this is a little bit about the relevancy, because sometimes I get the question of why did he use the term and so on. You said, if you want, I will say something about it later on during the Q&A, but for the time being, I just want to show you how relevant or how frequent that was in the literature, in the material itself. So for example, you see that Ben-Gurion says on Israeli-Turkish relations, they, the Turks, have always treated us as one treats a mistress and not as a partner in an openly avowed marriage. Another one, Iran's Prime Minister Ali Amini, during his meeting with Ben-Gurion in 61, Israel-Iran relations cannot become public. Our relations resemble true love between two people without getting married. Another Israeli diplomat in Istanbul, I would say that we are loved as a man loves his mistress, very much likes to enjoy her, but does not want to greet her on the street. Now, pay attention, this is interesting story. When he said doesn't want to greet her on the street, he referred to a very famous song by Heinrich Heine. Heinrich Heine has a very famous song about that when his mistress or a mistress is going in Unter den Linden, the famous, you know, street in Berlin, don't wave, don't say hi. We will meet later at home. And that became a famous poem that I found that many diplomats, probably they learned Heine, you know, at the university, they quoted. And he was, I think, referring to that without mentioning Heine. Yeah? Okay. Look at Meir Ezra. He was the Israeli unofficial ambassador. There was an ambassador, but not officially. Our activity in Iran, secretly and without formal recognition, was a nightmare for me. It was like a stormy love affair when the lover and his beloved woman are compelled to keep it in closed doors under the carpet. Yeah, it was a question of translation. We were active in many fields more than any other country, and our accomplishments were worthy. We had an excellent network of contacts, and we had access to many people in high echelons, but formally we did not exist. I mean, he was really frustrated. And when you read his memoir, he talks about it a lot. Okay, and finally, because that war appeared only last year, not 2 years ago. He's the general director of the Foreign Office, Ron Porosho. You have it also in Hebrew, anyone who reads Hebrew. This is the translation. Interlocutors did not want to admit in the existence of pro-daylight public relations. We would get to the meetings not from the front door, but from the workers' entrance, for the fear of leaks and the street response. In time, we realized that Israel would have to be the mistress and not the legal wife. Okay, so this is not something that was related to the 50s and the 60s. That was very much relevant to current days, not so long ago. Now, let's first of all deal with the question, why Middle East state and minority cooperate with Israel? It's a good question. So first of all, common enemies, as we said before, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is a very well-known Arab proverb, adu adu is sadiqi, which maybe come from the Bedouin culture, but anyway, in the Middle East, it's very familiar. And the fact that there are common interests, of course, the need for Israel's capability. They want to have Israeli weaponry, they want to have economic assistance, they want to have Israeli intelligence. The Mossad is very well known for his intelligence and so on. So Israel had a lot to give. And moreover, and that proved to be very important as time went by, a channel to get U.S. military, financial, and diplomatic support through the Jewish lobby and Israeli leaders. And here, the perception is very important. Why? Because sometimes comes the question, you know, of how strong is the Jewish lobby? Okay, some people say it's very strong. And you know what? I say it doesn't matter, or for that matter, because that's what people think. And therefore, it has been used. Like, you know, Tamir Pardo, the previous head of the Mossad, he was smiling and ironically, you know, he was saying something like, you know what? The protocols of the elders of Zion are working. That's what he said. You know, think about it, and, you know, usually you think about it from a negative point of view, but here you are taking this and you are using it. What about Israeli interest? First of all, that is very important, acquiring recognition and legitimacy. A strong sense of isolation, what we know as the people dwelling alone in the Bible, and insecurity regardless of the actual position, what I mentioned before, the siege mentality. Now here comes the point, because I said before, listen, it's secret, so many people, they don't know what about other countries and so on. So another head of Mossad, Shabtai Shavit, he said the following. Listen, among the security and the intelligence agency, everyone knows, I wouldn't say everything, but they know a lot. So once you cooperate secretly with someone, they know. And that helps us a lot, because it strengthens our position. So even though it's not publicly, still it is important for Israel to show that that is what it's doing. For example, when the Periphery Alliance was suggested, and that was a kind of success, I mean, relatively speaking, in the 50s and the 60s, the main idea behind it is to get to the United States and to show it, you know, listen, there are important allies here in the Middle East that are willing to cooperate with us. The Americans, by the way, were not convinced at that time, and they didn't support the Periphery Alliance. But still, this is the idea behind it. This is the logic behind it. And the common enemy, of course, we mentioned that before, the common interest, we mentioned that before, and the desire to acquire new markets for military and economic reasons. And yeah, I mean, whether it's arms, ammunition, economy, I mean, products, whatever. I mean, the markets were quite huge in Turkey. I mean, the amount of military exchange, for example, between Israel and Turkey in the 90s was unbelievable. The same applies to Israel and Iran before, until 79. Israel, for example, received the oil, not only from Iran, but later, after 79, you know, later on, from the Kurds. Can you imagine? I mean, it came from Kurdish territory and went a long way through Turkey, and then on ships came to Israel. So there were many common interests, you know, that served both sides. Now, let me, I will go into one of the case studies in order to give you some stuff meaningful, you know, about some of the kind of cooperation. First of all, look at the map. Now, the map in 2022 is completely different than the one that we had of the 60s, right? In terms of the colors, I mean, it's quite clear. Because what is quite widespread is the blue color. And the blue is diplomatic relations. At that time, we had only Turkey, right? So it's not that we're talking about Egypt, and we're talking about other countries like Jordan. Now we talk also about the countries in Africa. We're talking about Morocco, about the Emirates, about Bahrain. And so this is quite significant. I'm not discounting the enemies, which are important. We refer mainly to Iran, Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, and obviously Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. You can see them, it's very small. But they are there, yeah? And in yellow, these are countries that are irrelevant, or they are very much preoccupied with their own ideas or with their own problems. So therefore, I discounted them. But I mean, in general, the picture looks completely different than the 60s. So it means that Israel is in a completely different situation. So the maps try to show what I show in many words in the book, that Israel's role or place in the region and changed sort of dramatically, you know, from that mistress that nobody is willing to recognize it, to someone who is at least partially is being recognized publicly. Okay? Now, I want to add something about the whole notion of normalization. If you remember, I said something that it's mainly between governments. But again, the Abraham Accords, they changed something significant. And they introduced a new kind of normalization, which I called it full or legitimate normalization, which did not exist in the past. Because we are talking about connection between the people. It's people-to-people connection in Morocco, Bahrain, and the Emirates. And this is in complete contrast to the situation with Egypt and Jordan, where we hardly have any connection with the people. We have a very strong connection with the government, with the intelligence, with the armies, and so on. But no connection, almost no connection, on a cultural level, for example, which do exist with Morocco, the Emirates, and Bahrain. So it means that even if things change, they change slowly. And this is something that we have to remember as well. Okay, when we go to some of the details, let me give you just, you know, a couple of examples. First, let me say something about Israeli-Morocco relations. This is a very interesting story, because Morocco is different. It's different because of its Jewish community, which for many years played a very important role in Jewish life. And since the big Aliyah, the wave of immigration from Morocco, they kept the relations between the two countries. I mean, the Jewish community in Morocco, they also play a role in maintaining this relation, okay? But, and without any connection, there was a new channel between the Israeli Mossad and the Moroccan security services. And that happened, as I said before, from the early 60s, during the term of Meir Amit as the head of the Mossad. And what happened was that we received quite a lot of information on our enemy from the Moroccans. I'll give you an example. I'll give you a few examples. One of them, there was a short war between Algeria and Morocco in 1963. And the Moroccans, they captured a few Egyptian officers, Egyptian, who came to help Algeria. Nasser, Ben Bella, okay? We know that. So the Egyptian officers, I mean, the Moroccans allowed the Israelis to interrogate the Egyptian officers. And Ephraim Halevi, another previous head of the Mossad, said, we get a lot of information on the Egyptian army and on the Egyptian Soviet-made tanks at that time, and so on. So you have an interesting channel that he said it had us a lot in the 1967 war. One example. Another example. Arab summits. In Morocco, there were three Arab summits. In Casablanca, 65, in Fez, 2, in 81 and 82. And if I'm not mistaken, another one in Casablanca in 85. Anyway, in 65, the Israelis got from the Moroccans the protocols of the discussions of the Arab League. Now, remember, we're talking about before the Six-Day War. And Israel, I mean, feeling so isolated, you know, and at that time it was the war over the Jordan River and so on. So you get all the information from the closed session of the Arab leaders, president and prime minister meeting, and saying what they are saying, you know, with regard to Israel. Later on, I mean, you won't believe it, but in the 80s, the Morgon, they allowed the Israelis themselves to come and monitor, you know, the sessions and the talks. I mean, the Israelis themselves, they came and did the job, you know. They were allowed to do that. By the way, Israel was somehow indirectly, this is still a kind of an unknown, not fully known story of Mahdi Ben Berka assassination in 1965. He was a Moroccan opposition leader. He was killed by the Moroccan intelligence services. But Israel played a certain role. We don't know exactly what, but there was something there. There's something that we know, okay? And Israel, in many ways, after the Ben Berka affair, which was a disaster for the Moroccan, Israel actually established the Moroccan Secret Service. And Israeli from the Mossad, they went to Morocco and, you know, delivered lectures and gave them all the necessary information in order to build the organization. Israel also helped to, I wouldn't say to create, but, you know, there was a certain help with the SAVAK, the Iranian, you know, the very well-known and the cruel organization. Israel had some connections, probably sharing information for sure, and maybe more than that, but there was something there. So that is, for example, more. But I find that Saudi Arabia, for example, is one of the most interesting cases, because in my opinion, Saudi Arabia in general is a missed opportunity by Israel. Because the Saudis, after 67, the Saudis in general, their foreign policy is very pragmatic. They changed their position towards Israel. They accepted Israel in the 67 boundaries. And they did deliver the message to Britain and the United States, and it was delivered to Israel. But Israel did not want to listen for some reason. We had a certain perception of who are the Saudis, and we didn't think that they are so important. And I mean, I was surprised to find out that in the 70s, Crown Prince Fais, for example, he sent two emissaries to Israel, actually to talk with Dayan or with Begin, someone, talk with us. And they were rebuffed. They were sent away. I have no idea why. I cannot explain it, you know. And I think that, not that I'm saying that, you know, the next day something significant might have happened and there was a peace treaty and so on. But there were a lot of common interests, you have to understand, the same logic. Because, for example, when Israel was fighting Nasser and Nasserism, one of the grounds was in Yemen. Because in Yemen there was a civil war. And Yemen helped the Yemenis, okay? So at a certain point, the Yemenis, the rebels, they contact the Israelis and they ask for help. And we did send them arms and ammunition. We flew them, the ammunition, you know. And the big question is, to what extent the Saudis were aware of that? I don't have a good answer. But my feeling is that if they were, they say, why not? You know, the Yemenis, the rebels, are our allies. And
the royalists.
What?
You support the royalists.
We support the royalists.
Not the revolutionaries.
And he supported the revolutionaries, yes, exactly. And the Saudis, they supported the royalists, yes, exactly. So we were on the same camp. The same logic applied with Saddam Hussein, for example. Here I do have indications. You know, with Saddam Hussein, the Gulf War, and then the guy, Badr bin Sultan, he was an able Saudi ambassador in the United States for 2 decades. He met all the time Jewish leaders, and he met the Americans and said, we're willing to do this and that with Israel, they are not our enemies, and so on. Okay? So you do see a pattern in the Saudi behavior. And then there was the five-cliff plan in 1981, which Israel immediately rejected. And then was the Abdallah peace plan in 2002, which became the Arab peace plan, right? So again, you see here a pattern in the Saudi engagement with the Israelis. And this is something that we miss. And today, what Netanyahu is trying to do, he's trying to sign a deal with the Saudis. He's not going to get it, yes? But decision makers, they realize how important are the Saudis. But the Saudis, along the years, they were willing to do more. And we never tried it. I mean, we had put them to test and to see whether they were sincere. Maybe they were not. I don't know. But we had to do that. So I think that the Saudi case is highly interesting. Let me just end with this. I mean, I can show you if you want. This is a very thick book, okay? It's a very thick book. Something like 800 or more pages. Too much. Yeah, I know. But still, after I completed that thick book, there are a lot of black holes. I have no doubt about it. Because once you understand what is going on behind the scenes, you understand that there is still a lot of things that probably you don't know. And that's why I'm reading here, you know, it is taken from a Booker Prize winner, I'm sure that many of you know, Julian Barnes, which is a wonderful novel, The Sense of an Ending. And he says, "History is that certainty produced at the point where the imperfections of memory meet the inadequacies of documentation." And that's exactly the situation, I think, with our work. And at least if you are willing to admit that, I think you are in a better position. Okay, thank you very much.
Eli, that was an absolutely captivating presentation. I was optimistic about the chances of the English translation of your book until you picked it up. And I realized it's going to take more fundraising for the English translation than I had feared, which is, of course, bad news for all of us who are English readers.
It will be a shorter version, according to the contract.
Okay, then my hope lies in balance here, but I want to read it. I am so grateful to you, Eli, for the clarity with which you have given this exposition on your new book, taking us through the sources, the arguments, the case studies. You have definitely whetted our appetites to read more. Do not thank Avi Shlaim for reading it. If you don't get people like Avi Shlaim to read this book, one has no hope in publishing. But we look forward to the English edition for those of us who don't get through Hebrew to be able to add your knowledge to ours. Would you please join me in extending the warmest of thanks to anybody?